You're listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Los Angeles is filled with thousands of public employees, ranging from bus operators to maintenance and utility workers. Take Joe Valdivia. He began his career with LA County Public Libraries back in 2001. He was 21 years old then and working as a library aide. He sorted and stacked books, helped library patrons find what they were looking for, and kept the branch tidy. He didn't think back then that as a library worker, he would someday be trying to get a grip on the worst global health crisis in more than a century.
They tell you, you know, you will be called upon a natural disaster, something where you know, you're going to be needed. That's what is part of your job. And a lot of people take it in passing, like, okay, well, you know, sure, you know, that's fine. I'm getting my new job and that's good. You know, you're thinking earthquakes or you're thinking, you know, something to that degree. You're not thinking this. Nobody ever thought about this being, that's part of our duty, but you do take that oath. But I don't think anybody was taking that oath. I know I wasn't thinking about something to this caliber.
As it turns out, public employees like Joe sign an agreement, an oath, when they begin their civil servant job. It mandates them to become a disaster service worker in a time of emergency. So if there's some sort of natural disaster, any public employee in California can be called upon by the state to lend a hand. For Joe and hundreds of others in Los Angeles, that means they're working new jobs now as contact tracers. That means if you test positive for COVID-19, you might get a call from Joe asking who else you could have exposed. And with libraries closed at the moment, librarians all over the county are finding out they have a knack for this job. KCRW's Danielle Chiriguayo has this report from the folks on the virtual front lines who are tracking the virus.
When the pandemic first started, Joe worked at the Pico Rivera Library. There, he was in charge of managing the branch's workers. Now, as a contact tracer, Joe spends all day working from his garage, calling Angelenos who've gotten the bad news that they're infected with COVID-19 and asking them who else they've been around. Despite some initial uneasiness about the gig when he started in May, Joe's been pleasantly surprised by his new job so far.
We thought we were going to get a lot of hangups. We all know those telemarketers that call in the middle of the day. It's, you don't answer the phone. It's like, I don't know who that is. And they have been so inviting and trying to help. And, you know, I even tell them it might take like 20, 30 minutes maybe of your time. Is that okay? I can call you back at a more convenient time. And there's some of them are just saying, I'm not doing anything. I'm home. I got all the time in the world.
He often starts the conversations with the initial COVID-19 diagnosis.
You ask them if they've gotten their results for their COVID-19 testing. And then that's the point where you see where how you're going to go. And if they say, yes, I'm aware, then you notify them, okay, this is what you need to do. You need to stay isolated and you can't leave your home and don't be within close contact with anybody.
Then he asks who else they've been around. That can quickly turn into a web of connections.
That's your starting point. Because remember, you're trying to reach out to you've already reached out to those people that may or may not know. But now you have to reach out to the people that they were in contact with. And you have to, you know, get their information. So one person could lead to a number of people. So when you say, I got five people that I have to contact today, that can turn into 20, 25 people, 25 different personalities, different state of minds, ages, everything in between.
So how do you end up in a job like this? Well, state officials estimate 20,000 contact tracers will be needed to track the spread of infection through California. Folks like Joe and other library staff form a skilled but idle workforce of people who sign that public employee promise to help during times of disaster. Some have been assigned, while others have volunteered. So far, almost 300 staff from LA County and city libraries have joined contact tracing efforts. Hundreds of other library staffs have new jobs as translators at homeless shelters and even at COVID-19 testing sites. In the before times, Lupi Leyva worked as a librarian in Boyle Heights, where she grew up. When the chance to work as a contact tracer came a-knockin', Lupi ran to answer it. The lockdown's been hard on her family, and she sees this job as a way to bring an end to the pandemic faster.
My kids really, really, really wanted things to go back to normal. I have a high school senior who's missing out on prom and graduation and all that, and who is pretty scared she's not going to be able to go away to college in the fall. I think this is the way that I personally can contribute. I can take the skills that I have and I can put them to use to try to get life back to normal.
And so she did some research. She is a librarian, of course.
And one of the things that I realized as I was looking at what contract tracing involves is that my skills as a librarian are very well suited to what a contract tracer does.
At the reference desk, Loopy worked with people of all walks of life, and it's her job to listen and to figure out how to help them.
Empathy is one of the things that you have to have as a librarian at a reference desk. If you really want to be able to serve your community, you have to be able to take yourself out of who you are and put yourself in their shoes and try to think about their information needs. So there's a little bit of that detective work going on. Okay, what is this person's actual need?
That's been the experience of another librarian turned contact tracer, Laura Valdivia. Same last name as Joe because, well, she's his wife. She listens carefully to what COVID-positive people are experiencing and finds a way to help them come to terms with the need to self-isolate.
Several who have voiced their concerns about, you know, when can I go back to work? I have bills to pay. I need to buy groceries. You know, when you're telling them that they have to stay home and they have to isolate, we kind of have to do what we do in the library. We direct them to where they can find answers to those questions. You just have to, you know, be that person to listen to their concerns and you know, validate it. I absolutely understand what you're going through, and I feel for you. It's a difficult situation.
While it can be difficult to hear about the struggles people are facing, Joe Valdivia says it's rewarding to find that folks want to help as much as possible.
You know, and I met a lady over the phone. She had kids with her. You can hear the screaming in the back. And I told her, I completely understand. I can call you later if you like, or just give me whatever you can. She's like, no, I can help you out. I want to help out. I'll do this. And then she's yelled at her kid, hey, put that iPad lower. I'm talking on the phone. So we kind of built a little bit of a relationship and we were laughing about it. And she told me, she did feel a little sick, but she did say that, you know, she wants to help the cause and help me, help the department.
Joe says it makes him feel good to get that positive feedback. Contact tracing is not what he expected to be doing in his 19th year working at the library, but he sees the job as his duty to help others avoid the pain of dealing with COVID-19. He says he's going to keep at it relentlessly until the pandemic is over. For KCRW, I'm Danielle Chiriguayo.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Over the weekend, more protests for racial justice. Tens of thousands showed up in Hollywood, in West Hollywood, for an all Black Lives Matter march, a specific rally that coincided with LGBTQ Pride, a festival that had been derailed by the coronavirus pandemic. Meanwhile, a growing number of folks up in the Antelope Valley and High Desert are looking for answers in the deaths of two Black men who were found hanging from trees. Law enforcement officials say both incidents were likely suicides, but family, friends, and residents of Palmdale and Victorville say they are not buying that explanation, at least right now, and they want a full investigation. Many showed up to demonstrate in Palmdale. Let's hear.
Say his name!
Robert Fuller!
Say his name!
Robert Fuller!
Say his name!
Robert Fuller!
And KCRW's Cerise Castle has been covering the story. You hear the chant, say his name, Robert Fuller. She was out in the Antelope Valley over the weekend to cover that demonstration. Hey, Cerise.
Hey, Steve.
So let's start with where you were yesterday. The people who knew and loved Robert Fuller gathered in Palmdale. What are they asking for?
So the people of the Palmdale community have come together around this incident to really just demand transparency from the LA Sheriff's Department. Initially, when Robert Fuller was found, his death was labeled a suicide, and that really rubbed people the wrong way. As of now, there hasn't been any evidence that the Sheriff's Department has shared that would have led authorities to conclude that it was a suicide. They really just ruled that on the fact that it was a man hanging from a rope, and that really upset the community.
You talked to Fuller's sister, a woman named Diamond Alexander. She says her 24-year-old brother was not at all suicidal. Let's hear what she had to say.
This is really crazy to all of us. And we really are here to support Robert, and we really want to find out the truth of what really happened. Yeah. Robert was a good little brother to us. And it's like everything that they've been telling us has not been right. We've been hearing one thing, then we hear another. Right. And we just want to know the truth.
It's really heartbreaking. You mentioned, Cerise, that law enforcement officials say they don't have anything that really points to suicide. They just don't have any signs of foul play. I mean, was there a note? Did they look for signs of struggle? How do they make this clear determination so quickly?
So Captain Kent Wagner of the L.A. Sheriff's Department Homicide actually addressed this in a press conference this morning, and I'll let you hear what he has to say.
The point about what would have led us to believe that the death might have been a suicide at the beginning was more the lack of any evidence that there was any foul play.
Authorities also said at the press conference that they didn't find a stool or a chair at the scene, which, you know, one would think would be needed for someone to hang themselves in that manner. The community really is upset because, you know, when you're talking about a Black man being found hanging in a tree, given the historical context of that, saying it doesn't look like foul play is really just gaslighting the Black community.
Obviously, it's a disturbing story in a place that has a history of Black people being terrorized. Professor Raheem Kurwa is an assistant professor of criminology, law, and justice at the University of Illinois in Chicago, and he is the author of Apartheid's Afterlives, Policing Black Life in the Antelope Valley. Professor, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, and I want to express my sympathies to the family of Robert Fuller as well.
Yeah, and there were two, by the way, and we should mention there was another Black person who was found hanged in a tree in Victorville, about 50 miles away, also in the high desert. Give us some idea of the history and the scope of racism in that part of California, that part of even of L.A. County and San Bernardino County.
Yeah, well, I think there is sort of a common misconception, especially in L.A. County, that places like the Antelope Valley, these suburban areas, have sort of been all white or historically white places, and that perhaps they even should continue to be to this day. And in reality, they've had long histories of Black residency and Black contributions, all the way dating back to the Reconstruction era when Charles Graves, a former slave, moved out to the Antelope Valley and built one of the first schools in Rosamond. And that history continues into the early 1900s and the construction of a neighborhood called Sun Village during the era of segregation in Los Angeles County, where Black families were living and working in the Antelope Valley, but were not allowed to live in Palmdale or in Lancaster. And Sun Village was the site of amazing civil rights organizing by folks like Lois Patton and Daisy Gibson. And once the civil rights movement was successful in establishing fair housing law, Sun Village sort of and Palmdale desegregated, and Black residents were able to move into the rest of the Antelope Valley. The decades that followed saw numerous hate crimes and mechanisms of discrimination in terms of in workplaces, you know, and in other in education and other sectors of life. And these sometimes included things like cross burnings, swastikas, and hate crimes, which I think people, you know, still echoes throughout the valley today. And even in the early 1990s, a skinhead group called the Nazi Lowriders really ran roughshod over the Antelope Valley. The 1990s also saw the largest housing discrimination lawsuit of its time in the nation settled in the Antelope Valley.
Professor, how would you characterize the relationship between the Black community and the police there in the Antelope Valley?
Well, that gets to a number of issues of that are really very relevant and an important context. So in the 2000s, the Department of Justice performed an investigation of LA Sheriff's Department policing practices in the Antelope Valley and found them to be unconstitutional, specifically related to stops, searches, putting people who are being searched into the back of the car before any determination is made about, you know, what the issue was, and specifically around use of force. And that was a sort of first domino to fall. But the second one was the uncovering of the use of policing tactics to evict Black residents who were renting homes in the Antelope Valley through the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher program. And so these are two major policing incidents that really illustrated some very questionable and sometimes clearly unconstitutional practices that I think are very important context to understanding why there is mistrust, why some of the context for what is happening today.
Let's fast forward to today, and L.A. County Sheriff Alex Villanueva spoke about the Robert Fuller case earlier. Here's some of what he had to say about the investigation going forward.
It touches in everyone's heart because Robert Fuller was a young man in the prime of his life, and his death obviously is painful for many people. So my condolences to the Fuller family, and we hopefully with this death investigation will answer all the questions and we'll give full closure to what happened here.
That's Sheriff Villanueva. This is in L.A. County Sheriff's jurisdiction in Palmdale, Cerise Castle. What's really adding to the questions about all this is the fact that there was another Black man, as I mentioned, who'd been found hanged from a tree in Victorville, about 50 miles away. This is also in the high desert, but in San Bernardino County. What do you know about the circumstances concerning the death of Malcolm Harsh?
So the circumstances surrounding his death have really been kept very hush-hush by the San Bernardino Sheriff's Department. In the release that they put out, the only real information that was given was that this was also determined to be a suicide, that an investigation is ongoing, but you know, they're taking the position that it was a suicide. Harsh's family reached out to a local paper in Victorville and said that, you know, they didn't believe that this was a suicide. They had actually recently spoken to Mr. Harsh, and he had said that he had plans to come back to where they are based, which is in Ohio, and visit with his family and children. So hearing from the sheriff's department that he killed himself, they're not really buying it.
So they're the same questions, right, that the family of Mr. Harsh have with the family of Mr. Fuller.
Exactly, Steve. You know, both of these sheriff's departments seemingly made this determination really quickly without really giving the family or community any evidence that these men killed themselves by their own hand. And as I said before, the positioning of those bodies in trees, that's a callback to lynching that was, you know, a form of terrorism that was carried out against Black people in this country for generations. And saying that a Black man in a tree, you know, doesn't really suggest any signs of foul play is really making a mockery of that history. And also, Steve, adding to this, the LA Sheriff's Department just this weekend killed another Black man. His name was Michael Thomas. This was in a reported domestic dispute. The Sheriff's Department, again, hasn't really released any information about this death, and it's prompting the community to keep up these protests and continue to come out. And I'd also want to mention that, you know, the culture of white supremacy in the Palmdale Antelope Valley area is really deep rooted. You know, just a couple of years ago, there was an incident where a photo was being circulated of teachers in the Palmdale school district posing with a noose.
Well, there's a lot going on there, obviously. I know the L.A. County Supervisor, Cerise Catherine Barger, is calling for an investigation through the Attorney General's office. I know the FBI, Sheriff Villanueva, even said the FBI perhaps could be involved in this case as well, correct?
That's correct, Steve. The FBI, yeah. As well as the Attorney General's office, will be monitoring.
All right. KCRW, Cerise Castle reporting for us. Cerise, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
And Professor Raheem Kurwa from the University of Illinois, Chicago. Thank you, sir, as well.
Thank you.
Back now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Let's head down to the intersection of Pandemic and Orange County. At the end of May, the head of the Orange County Health Agency, Dr. Nicole Quick, announced a new rule. Wearing a mask was mandatory when you're out in public. Well, quite a few OC residents were not happy with that order, and at a county board meeting, they let their supervisors know it.
Regarding the masks, I ride a bike. I can't wear a mask and see very well. People are driving with masks, and it cuts off their vision. You really don't have this peripheral. You're looking up. There's so many more accidents.
This is like a dictatorship, and this new ordinance, it was like a punch in the gut to me because it felt like suddenly one person is going to decide for all of us that we have to wear a face mask. Where are we going to shop now?
Because this is treason, destroying our country from within. The Hyperflu, no one's buying it. Go to Huntington Beach and you'll see. It's crowded. It's freedom.
Meanwhile, numbers keep going up for people testing positive for COVID-19. Over the weekend, OC hit a record for a daily rise in cases. Gustavo Arellano writes for the LA Times. He's here with KCRW's Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
As I mentioned, the head of the healthcare agency, Dr. Quick, mandated that anyone out in public had to be wearing a face mask. We heard the complaints at the supervisors meeting. A lot of folks were upset about it. Have people come to the defense of Dr. Quick saying, hey, you know, she's just doing her job?
No, most of the criticisms, of course, you see stuff online and people calling into talk shows and whatnot. But what happened there at the Board of Supervisors meeting, drew national attention and also drew a lot of disgust from other Orange County residents. There was only one person who spoke in Dr. Quick's defense. Meanwhile, Dr. Quick had her address leaked online, had protests at her home, had death threats. It wasn't a surprise that she ended up resigning, fearing for her own safety. And meanwhile, it's interesting. It depends on what part of Orange County you're at. So yeah, in Huntington Beach, a lot of people are not wearing masks. In Santana, where my wife has her store, and in Anaheim, where most of my family lives, almost everyone I see out on the street is wearing a mask.
So Dr. Quick resigned. There was a lot of pressure on her. She's out. Who's her replacement?
So right now, the acting county health officer is Clayton Chow, who's the agency director for OC Health. So he's temporary, although who really wants the job right now if you're going to have to hear a bunch of people calling you treasonous and trying to destroy liberty in Orange County? And this is not the first resignation that we've seen at the county health agency ever since coronavirus popped up in mid-March. You've seen at least two other high-profile people resign and not really offering anything other than the stress of the job is just getting to them. And by stress, I don't just mean the public, but I also mean a board of supervisors that has been openly skeptical about both the strength of coronavirus, of how dangerous it is, and also the idea that wearing masks might be able to stop the spread of coronavirus.
What is Dr. Clayton Chow's opinion on the mandating of mask wearing? He's probably not going to want to wade into this debate, but he's got to have an opinion about it, right? He just can't make a mandate? Is that what it is? Or
well, now the mandate is that you're suggested to be wearing masks if you're out in public and you can't practice social distancing. Again, the Board of Supervisors has pressed them. Well, how do you know that masks do stop the spread of coronavirus? Which, you know, to the point of the woman who was saying that, oh, I can't wear a mask and be able to ride my bike. I wear a mask when I'm in my car. My peripheral vision is just fine. It's as good as Bob Cousy's.
So the mandate is no longer. It's a suggestion now. It all comes on the heels, by the way, of more news. New virus cases are up in recent days, topping 300 over the weekend, the first time that's happened since the pandemic began. Is there any concern that the county isn't doing enough? I mean, our supervisors are saying, well, wait a second, these numbers are way up.
No, the Board of Supervisors, specifically Don Wagner and Michelle Steele, they really act like coronavirus is no big deal. In late April, Michelle Steele sent out a press release saying that hospitalizations were falling in Orange County due to COVID-19 and that Orange County had flattened the curve. But in the past about 10 days, you've seen four of the highest case totals, with the most recent one yesterday being the highest ever, 304. Hospitalizations continue to go up. Meanwhile, testing has plummeted. So on top of having the highest total cases for one day yesterday, we've also seen the lowest testing period since the county started tracking them at the end of April, with only 719. So you end up with an average of about 42% of the tests have come positive. Now, in baseball, that's a great batting average, but that's not an average that you want when it comes to coronavirus.
So, I mean, is there going to be any more discussion about that? Is it just the end of the debate now? This is just the way it's going to be, and we're just going to hope for the best going forward.
that's what a lot of folks in government in Orange County are saying. It's like, well, you can't live in fear. We just got to go through with it. Wearing masks, it has not proven anything. Never mind that in the 1918 Spanish flu, the cities that had more of a harder mask mandate had less deaths than those who said, we don't need the mask. So I wish people would listen to history. I wish people would read history. Obviously, we're Americans. For us, history is just what's in front of us, and we can manipulate it to our own ends. And if things get broken in the way, well, oh well.
The musings of Gustavo Arellano, who writes for the LA Times, a regular here, obviously on Greater LA as well. Gustavo, as always, thanks.
Gracias.
Well, that's it for today. Tomorrow, divest, defund, abolish the police. But what do those terms really mean? Turns out, they don't always mean what you think. And the city of L.A. is debating what to do. We're going to tell you more about it tomorrow. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Share your thoughts with us, so many thoughts. And subscribe to the podcast, too, while you're there, kcrw.com/greaterLA. Stay tuned to KCRW for the latest news, of course, as it warrants. Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Aaron Sine, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Ray Guana, Desmond Taylor, Christine Comito, and Christian Bordahl all made this show happen. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ears and for your attention. Please stay safe. Have a great day.